Welcome to the New Books in Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the channel with Carrie Figder. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. Today, my guest is Professor R.J. Wallace. We'll be talking about his new book, The View from Here, on Affirmation, Attachment, and the Limits of Regret, which is newly published by Oxford University Press. J. Wallace is professor of philosophy at the University of California at Berkeley. Our moral lives are shot through with concerns about the past. Only a lucky few, if anyone at all, can escape nagging and persistent regrets about actions and decisions in our pasts. But sometimes those very decisions that we now regret are the causal or conceptual antecedents of further outcomes that we now must affirm. That is, when we look back on our lives, we often find certain features of our past lamentable, even though without those very features, something of value in our present would not be. How is this mixture of regret and affirmation to be understood? In The View from Here, J. Wallace explores the complicated phenomena concerning regret and affirmation. He develops a view that reconciles the apparent contradiction between regretting something that was a necessary antecedent to something that one must, in the present, affirm. But in laying out this reconciliation, Wallace uncovers a pervasive and deeply disconcerting truth about the human condition. Namely, that we must affirm aspects of our lives that are undeniably the products of highly objectionable features of the past. The View from Here is a thoroughly compelling and deeply intriguing work of moral philosophy. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, J. Wallace.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine, thanks, Bob.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Philosophy.
You're welcome. Thanks for your interest in talking about my new book.
Well, wonderful. Today, folks, on New Books in Philosophy, my guest is R.J. Wallace, who has just published a book with Oxford University Press titled The View from Here on Affirmation, Attachment, and the Limits of Regret. This book explores the range of moral phenomena that attach to those retrospective assessments that we make of our own pasts. As its subtitle indicates, the book essentially focused on interrelated questions concerning regret and affirmation. In particular, Wallace is concerned with cases in which it seems as if one must regret something in the past that is nonetheless causally or conceptually the antecedent of some subsequent outcome that we must affirm or have some positive affect towards. This is a deep and compelling book, and I highly recommend it. And there are lots of details here that we'll be discussing in this interview. But before we get into those details, Jay, why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, thanks, Bob. My personal biography, I don't think is particularly interesting or compelling. You know, I was a Navy brat growing up, so I lived all over the place, moved every couple of years. So it's a little bit hard to say where I'm from when people ask me that question, which I think is a predicament I share with many people who grew up in military families. My family roots are in New England, and I spent a lot of my childhood there. And you know, think of New England as home as much as any place is. But not because I really spent all of my childhood there. It's just that's where our family roots go back. I was educated at Williams College, and where I did the BA degree, and then at Oxford University, where I did the BPhil, and Princeton, where I pursued the PhD degree. And since Princeton, I've taught at a number of different institutions. I was at the University of Pennsylvania for many years, and then unusually, perhaps, I spent a period of several years in the late 1990s in Germany, in Berlin, where I was a professor at the Humboldt University, which I very much enjoyed, and I still have strong ties to Germany and the German academic community, and go back there frequently. But since 2000, I've been a professor at the University of California at Berkeley in the Department of Philosophy, which I continue to enjoy and find especially happy and stimulating intellectual community and intellectual home. I'm someone who works in moral philosophy, and I understand that really in the broadest sense. In our incredibly hyper-professionalized contemporary philosophical discipline, it's common for people to think of themselves and think of their interests in terms of fairly narrow categories, and that just doesn't work for me. I'm interested in metaethics and moral psychology and normative ethics and broader questions about practical reason and conceptions of the self and value, and how all of these different things fit together and relate to each other. So I can't honestly say that I'm interested only in some parts of the subject as opposed to others. In fact, what I find gripping about moral philosophy as a set of intellectual questions is, in some ways, the interconnections between the different parts of the subject, which I think give it a lot of its compelling character. You can't really understand issues in normative ethics without seeing their connection to questions in the theory of practical reason and in moral psychology and so on. In terms of my published work, I've written on a fairly correspondingly kind of wide range of topics. My first book was Responsibility in the Moral Sentence, which was on the hoary question of the nature of moral responsibility and the compatibility of responsibility and determinism or a naturalistic explanatory outlook on things. I've worked extensively on problems in the theory of practical reason and moral psychology. Some of my papers in there, those areas are collected in a book called Normativity and the Will. I've edited a number of collections, and my interests extend even in historical directions as well. So that's a little bit about about my personal intellectual biography.
Great. Well, let me pick up on the way you characterized the breadth of your interest in moral philosophy, and ask you a question about the maybe the methodological commitments that are lying behind the new book, The View from Here. It seems to me that the View from Here is distinctive in a way, in that as a work in moral philosophy, in that it's almost exclusively focused on sort of backward-looking moral assessments. Now, I don't have to tell you, and I'm sure most of our listeners will be aware that a lot of moral philosophy that gets done either tends to focus on the sort of present time moral assessment, or something prospective, like what should some agent do given some circumstances, moving forward in the world. But this book is instead focused on these retrospective attitudes, looking back on our lives or looking back on particular events. So let me ask the question: does this reflect a feature of your conception of moral philosophy, or a methodological commitment on your part?
That's a great question, Bob. And in some ways, it brings out something I wasn't even particularly conscious of in writing the book, which is a certain continuity between themes I explore here and in some of my earlier work on responsibility, where I'm very exercised by the question of what it is to hold people responsible and to take an attitude of blame toward what they've done, or to blame oneself. And these are themselves retrospective attitudes, right? I guess a minimal kind of methodological commitment that I have is to seeing moral standards as not only regulating our forward-looking decisions, which is, of course, their one of their primary loci of application. You know, you've been in deliberation and deciding what to do. One refers to moral standards and principles and takes them seriously as providing important reasons for action or for refraining from things one would otherwise be tempted or inclined to do. That is an important dimension of morality, but it's also, I think, an important basis for retrospective assessment. You know, the fact that someone acted wrongly or perhaps wronged someone else in their interactions, changes their relations to the people who've been affected by what was done in ways that give those people, grounds for retrospective attitudes that wouldn't otherwise be in place. You know, resentment. In my earlier book on responsibility, drawing on themes from Strawson, I emphasize the importance of the moral backward-looking moral sentiments like resentment and guilt and indignation to the stance of holding someone responsible, which are in effect backward-looking attitudes towards something people have done. And you know, the general idea is that it's important that morality should provide a basis for responsibility relations between people, which are relations that are structured in terms of these negative backward assessments. I think one important methodological commitment when it comes to understanding morality is just seeing how moral principles can function not just as forward-looking guides to action, but also as a basis for responsibility relations, which have an important retrospective dimension. Responsibility relations between people. That's a general commitment. The book does not, however, focus just on questions of moral assessment. That's one of the questions that are at issue, but looks more generally at our retrospective attitudes towards our lives and the personal and impersonal conditions that shape our lives and the attitudes we take toward those things when we look back on them in reflection. And my interest in this this broader set of issues is connected to a longstanding concern with themes in the moral philosophy of Bernard Williams,
right,
who I think is was this idea of the retrospective point of view as a point of view that is distinctively perspectival and shaped by one's present projects and relationships and what I call in the new book attachments. This is I think a really important theme in Williams's work, and the book emerged really out of sustained reflection about that began with thinking about the argument of one of Williams's most famous papers, Moral Luck, and
right,
the example of a kind of stylized Paul Gauguin, right, who in Moral Luck, leaves his family in the lurch in Paris to go off to Tahiti to become to develop as a painter. And Williams is what an interestingly neglected, I think it's the main crux of his argument, but it's strangely neglected in the literature on moral luck. But one of Williams's major contentions in the paper is that the question of whether Gauguin was justified in leaving his family behind in Paris is hostage to fortune at a time when he took the decision. And in particular, it all depends on whether he ends up being, a successful artist in a certain sense.
Right.
And if he does, then Williams's argument is that the successful Gauguin will not be able to look back on his earlier decision and to regret it.
Right.
And and furthermore, Williams claims that inability to regret his earlier decision amounts to a retrospective justification of that decision.
Well, that's right. So let me ask then about this feature that keeps getting that progressively gets developed in your book, because you lay out you keep returning to the Williams example, and you develop a framework which is comprised of a kind of continuum between different strengths of regret on the one hand, at the extreme end. What you call all-in regret. Yeah. And then on the other side of the spectrum, there's different strengths of affirmation. And at the extreme other end, there's unconditional affirmation. And so I take it that you want to criticize or resist, let's say, the Williams conclusion, which is, as you just put it, right, the fact that abandoning the family in Paris was a condition for the artistic achievement, which was something greatly valuable, right? Not only to the artist, but to lots of other people and lots of people who didn't exist at the time that he achieved it and all the rest, that somehow Williams thinks that, firstly, that the that Gauguin couldn't regret the decision he made to abandon his family, and secondly, that because he couldn't regret that decision, the decision plays some kind of or gets some kind of positive moral evaluation or something. Yeah. That there's a new kind of moral justification, given that it was the condition for the possibility of, we might say, the artistic achievement. Now, I take it that the framework between the different strengths of regret and affirmation is what's carving out space for you to say, in response to this case, something that I will confess sounds to me far more sensible.
Okay. I'm pleased to hear that. Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about how that those categories work and how you would offer a different analysis of the Gauguin case?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to do that. I think you really nicely laid out the issues raised by the Gauguin example in terms of two questions first, why can't the successful Gauguin regret the earlier decision? And second, what are the implications of his inability to regret for the question of justification? The apparatus of distinctions in retrospective attitudes that you refer to is really an attempt, in the first instance, to make sense of the first of these questions. You know, I find what William says about this case really extremely suggestive, but there's, to make sense of it, it seems like we need a better account of the nature of regret and what it is in regret and in its relation to affirmation that precludes a certain kind of regret on the part of someone like Gauguin. And so to make sense of this, I introduced these categories that you mentioned. One of them is the phenomenon of all-in regret, as opposed to merely having regrets about something. In the most generic sense, to regret something is to have some, a pained consciousness, perhaps, of some event or circumstance in the past that has an unfortunate dimension. And in that very generic sense, there's nothing that would preclude even the very successful Gauguin from regretting or having regrets about the family the destitute family he left behind in Paris. He can think back and have a pained consciousness about that, just as he can look back on all kinds of things and have a pained consciousness about them. What it seems to me, if we're going to make sense of this argument, is not open to the successful Gauguin, is all-in regret, which is a specific attitude that involves, as it were, an unbalanced preference, a quasi-intention-like attitude that things should have been otherwise in the respect that occasions present pain or sorrow about them. So, what I imagine, Gauguin unable to do is to look back on his decision and to wish on balance that he hadn't decided to leave Paris, right? And I think that's the kind of thing that Williams must be assuming is is not available to the successful Gauguin. Now, why isn't that available to Gauguin? I think the reason is that that earlier decision becomes a historical condition for basically the project that gives the successful Gauguin his primary basis for affirming his life, right? He affirms his life. He prefers that he has a kind of positive attitude towards his life on account of the role in that life of his successful artistic projects. And my hypothesis on Williams's behalf is that the reason why Williams thinks that Gauguin can't regret in this all in way the earlier decision is that it conditions this the thing that provides him with a basis for affirming his life. Now, affirming one's life in this unconditional way is basically, preferring on balance that one should have lived the actual life that one lived, as opposed to, the alternative that one shouldn't have lived at all. It's a fairly minimal condition, but the idea is that this affirmative attitude, is rightly described as the attitude of affirming one's life, and it has it's an attitude that reflects a kind of attachment to one's own life and to the things in one's life that give it meaning. And this relation to attachment, I think, expresses itself in the further idea that affirmation in these cases has a kind of unconditional character. So to affirm one's life unconditionally is to prefer on balance the actual life one has led, and in a way that commits one in turn to affirming the historical conditions of that life. So at this point we see the incompatibility of unconditional affirmation of one's life and all in regret about one of its conditions. Those two attitudes, as I try to refine and interpret them, really can't be combined coherently. And so, right. So it's the unconditional affirmation of Gauguin's life that precludes all in regret about the decision that made possible its defining his later defining project. So that's the structure of attitudes that recurs then throughout the book in a variety of other contexts as well.
Right. So let me just ask one further part of the structure here, because in describing the attitudes, the various strengths of regret and affirmation, you've made reference to attachment and to projects.
Yes.
So can you tell us a little bit explicitly about the attachment? I take it that the story would be much different if Gauguin didn't have wasn't attached to his artistic products his way of life, that somehow these different attitudes, regret and affirmation, are sort of indexed to projects or attachments or ground projects or yes. something of this kind.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit explicitly about the role that element plays in the structure?
Okay, very good. The most general terms, this word attachment is standing in for the sorts of things that Williams variously talked about as ground projects or as categorical desires. Relationships are obviously they were important to Williams and to other philosophers, and they're a prominent example of the phenomenon of attachment. One is attached to the people one loves, Christine Korsgaard's talk about practical identities and the source of normativity is a different vocabulary I think we could use for talking about similar sorts of things. The basic idea is that these attachments in these sense basically constitute the perspective from which we reflect when we look back on earlier decisions and aspects of our life and reflect on them in evaluative terms. And it's attachments specifically that in some way commit us to affirming earlier decisions and conditions that we faced, decisions we made and conditions we faced. And it's attachments in this sense that also preclude for the same reasons, attitudes of awe and regret about some of the same earlier decisions and conditions. So the idea is that, you know, it's a part of the nature of attachment that it generates a kind of and provides a basis for unconditional attitudes of affirmation, which have this kind of dynamic quality that they commit us to affirming, you know, the conditions for the things that we immediately affirm themselves. Relationships are perhaps the clearest example of this. You know, if you love someone and you're glad on balance that the person exists and is part of your life, and that attitude, I think very naturally spreads back to the historical conditions of the person you love. You're committed in virtue of your affirmative attitude toward the person to affirming that the conditions obtained that brought them into existence in the first place. So that, you know, though we don't often think in these terms, but it seems to me it's a simple truth that if you love someone, you can't really regret the conditions that made it possible for them to come into existence in the first place.
Well, that's a good place to break in and ask about the other recurring example in the book, which is precisely maybe as I was reading it, I was thinking, oh, this is the kind of example that really makes very good sense of the attachment aspect of this, because you consider a case that in some ways is structurally similar to the Williams case about Gauguin, but is in fact about a woman who, when she is very young, decides to bear a child,
right,
under conditions under which it would seem morally objectionable for somebody that young, under those circumstances, such as you describe them, to bear a child. There are moral questions about the young woman's ability to provide the necessary care and attention,
right,
given her young age. And then later in the life of the child, things, I guess we could say, go fairly well. And now the woman who is now a mother can't help but affirm this outcome, while also, you argue, being able to judge the circumstances, the decision that she made when she was still, you know, very young, in a way that's not positively wholesalely positively morally valent, right? So can you tell us a little bit about the young mother case?
Good, excellent. Yeah, well, you've given a nice description of the case. The idea is that at the time when the young mother basically decides to conceive a child, there are compelling reasons, not just moral reasons, moral reasons in part, but also prudential reasons in the broader sense, not to conceive a child at that stage in her life. We could say that, you know, the decision to do that wasn't justified either morally or prudentially at the time when it was taken. Nevertheless, once the child exists, in the case, on the minimal assumption that the child's life is worth living on balance, both the child and the mother are going to, for different reasons in the different cases, they're going to look back on that decision and, in my sense, be unable to regret it in this all-in way, be committed to affirming it. And this, as you say, nicely illustrates, a feature of the way in which present attachments shape our retrospective point of view. The mother's attachment or love to or love for the child commits her really to affirming the decision that she made to conceive when she looks back on it, since that condition that decision was a condition for the existence of the child whom she's now attached to. Now, this case was introduced into philosophical discussions originally by Derek Parfit in the context of a different debate about the so-called non-identity problem. And it's not really my main intention to solve the non-identity problem in this case. But what interests me is precisely the point that you mentioned, which is that the case has a kind of structural parallel that I think is illuminating to Williams's Gauguin case. But I think the parallel works against Williams's conclusion. Now, if we go back to the Williams case, you'd mentioned earlier that on Williams's view, the hypothesized inability of Gauguin, successful Gauguin, to regret his earlier decision, in Williams's view, amounts to a retrospective justification for that decision. And that's the element of luck in the Gauguin case. At the time when Gauguin made the decision, he couldn't know whether he'd be successful, but whether he is successful as an artist will determine in turn whether that decision comes to be justified or not by his artistic success. So the idea is that Gauguin's inability to regret the earlier decision amounts to an ex post facto justification for it. Not really a moral justification per se. You know, artistic success doesn't give Gauguin, and I think Williams is clear enough about this, it doesn't give him something that silences the complaints that his children might have about what he's done to them, but it justifies it in some broader rational sense from Gauguin's perspective. That's Williams's thesis. But this has come to seem very questionable to me. It seems to me, and I think that what's wrong with it is brought out pretty clearly by the young mother case. In the case of the young girl's child, I don't think we want to say that the decision to conceive a child at that stage in life, when she was still a young teenager, comes to be justified by her later inability to regret the decision. Right? It was a mistaken decision to make. There are moral and prudential reasons not to make decisions of this kind when you're in those circumstances. The mother will still affirm those reasons when she thinks about the situation of other. You know, girls who are in the same situation today, and it just seems to me misleading to think that her inability to regret the earlier decision, in virtue of her attachment to the child to whom she gave birth, constitutes some kind of retrospective justification for it. Rather, the natural thing to say is just that circumstances have changed. She's come through her earlier mistaken decision, a new attachment has come into her life, in virtue of which she's unable to regret this decision that continues to be a decision that was mistaken or unjustified. So there's a mistaken or wrong decision that is inaccessible to retrospective regret in virtue of the attachments that have come into her life in the intervening period. And I think this is just a kind of structural feature of the backward, the retrospective point of view. It's shaped by attachments that that emerge and that alter our relation to the past events that we look back on in ways that can interestingly lead us to be unable to regret past decisions or circumstances that were lamentable or that were mistaken, and that commit us to affirming things that are in the same way problematic or mistaken when we look back on them. So applying that lesson to the Gauguin case, we can perhaps concede to Williams that the successful Gauguin can't regret his earlier decision to live to leave his family behind, but resist nevertheless Williams's conclusion that his decision is justified retrospectively by Gauguin's later success. That's just not the way it works. On the contrary, it seems to me just a feature of the human predicament that that our retrospective point of view often introduces rifts between the standpoint of retrospective assessment and the standpoint of agents at the time of the events that we're looking back on, such that there are lots of mistaken or unjustified or morally objectionable decisions or circumstances that people might nevertheless, when they look back on them, be committed in virtue of their attachments to affirming.
Let me ask you sort of a question about one of the ways in which the Williams case and the young mother case are not quite analogous. Yeah. I take it that and you discuss this in the book, so this is not a coming out of a field, as it were. But it seems that our listeners who are familiar with the Williams case might say, well, the thing that's missing in the young mother case is the moral luck aspect. Mm-hmm. That is, the mother can know in advance.
Yes.
That if she has her child, the future her will have an attachment to something,
right,
and affirm something.
Yeah.
The Gauguin case is a case in which we could very easily imagine, because let's face it, the world is there are far more failed artists in the world than successful ones, right? Where the artist takes this, does this, abandons his family,
right,
and then winds up with nothing that's affirmable.
Right.
And so it seems that in the Williams case, the fortune that the product was something that one could be attached to.
Yes.
is an important element of the story. Does that change how do you deal with that?
Yeah.
Well, let me just ask, do you think that's a relevant disanalogy?
Well, I know. I think it's a striking disanalogy between the cases. And it's absolutely right. It's predictable. Parents predictably develop attachments to their children. And so it's perfectly predictable in advance that the...
And when they don't, develop those attachments, it's a problem with the parents, right? We diagnose them. It's not it's never very rarely taken as an assessment, of the child, right?
So it's, I agree. It's completely predictable in that case. There's very little epistemic luck, at the time of the decision, with respect to the question of whether the mother's going to look back on it affirmatively or not, and that does contrast with the Gauguin case. I agree and think that's an interesting contrast. The problem is the contrast doesn't help Williams's argument. I mean, the crucial thing for Williams is that the later inability to regret the decision on the part of the successful Gauguin basically affects the question of whether the decision was justified after all. So that it's a matter of epistemic luck at the time when he made the decision whether it will turn out to be justified. But if the as I argue, the inability to regret, the inaccessibility to regret for the earlier decision of the successful Gauguin does not amount to a retrospective justification, then it doesn't turn out. It turns out that the justification of his decision isn't subject to epistemic luck after all. We don't need to know whether Gauguin is successful and therefore able to affirm or regret in this all in way his decision to know whether it was justified. We can just look at the circumstances that obtained at the time when he made the decision. And it seems to me that, that there's a compelling reason for thinking that it wasn't justified on those grounds, and that, nothing about his later success or lack of it as an artist affects that. That fundamental question of justification.
Right. Very good. Let me move on, if I may,
sure.
Because at the close of chapter three, there are a couple of pages that I found really, really interesting, in which you comment on certain discourses concerning disability and disability
yes.
communities, and you bring your analysis of the different strengths of regret and the compatibility of different forms of regret with affirmation to bear on certain questions about affirming a life that popularly would be called a life where there's prevalent disabilities, and what that means in people's reasoning about children to disabled couples and so on
yes.
and so forth. Can you tell us a little bit about that discussion?
Sure. Yeah, happy to do that. So, I mean, at this point in the argument, I'm shifting my focus a little bit from, the cases we've talked about so far, the Gauguin case and the young girl's mother, involve cases where we imagine agents looking back on some decision that they have taken in the past that then shapes their subsequent life. And the way in which their present attachments, when they look back on these decisions, affect their ability to regret or to affirm the things they look back on. But I think something like the same dynamic, emerges when we look back not just on decisions we've taken, but on circumstances that shape our life, our lives in various ways. And, among the personal circumstances that can very profoundly shape one's life are, the physical and mental capacities that one is born with. And my idea here is that, a situation is I think, easily conceivable where a developmental condition that we would ordinarily characterize as a kind of disability it doesn't result from a decision someone's taken. It's just a feature of their life. Someone might have been born without the capacity to hear, for instance. But that feature of their abilities and capacities will presumably, in many cases, shape their defining projects and activities as adults in ways that could leave them unable to regret those decisions insofar as those decisions those conditions insofar as the conditions have come to shape the activities that define and give meaning to their life. So I assume that members of the hearing impaired community participate in forms of human culture that are immensely valuable, that involve sign language and abilities to to communicate without hearing that define these communities. And someone who's grown up in this environment and who could in virtue of the attachments that have come to define their adult life find themselves for structurally similar reasons committed to affirming the hearing impairment that has shaped their defining projects as adults. Now, my suggestion is that being in this kind of relation to the conditions that define your adult activities doesn't amount, to the conclusion that it's in general valuable or desirable that other human beings who have opportunities to overcome these same conditions should not be provided with the opportunities to do so. So, an interesting case that is much discussed involves, decisions of that parents might take to have their hearing impaired children have them equipped with cochlear implants. And, my suggestion is that a parent in this situation might be committed to affirming their own condition of deafness insofar as that conditions the adult activities that have come to define their lives without necessarily being committed in virtue of that attitude to thinking that it would be better for their own children to be deprived of the opportunities to participate in hearing the hearing culture by having cochlear implants equipped. We find a similar situation where someone has a condition that might in general be described as an impairment, but is committed in virtue of its relation to their defining life activities to affirming that condition in their own case. And the suggestion is that's a perfectly intelligible condition, but it doesn't amount to the judgment that it's in general better for people to lack the capacity to hear. And in particular, it doesn't provide a justification for, for the decision to not to provide some hearing capacities to their own children if opportunities to do that are available.
Right, and it seems also to equip hearing impaired parents who opt for cochlear implants for their children to deflect criticisms that that decision amounts to practically taking a negative attitude towards their own deafness.
Exactly. Yes. No. I think the our attitudes are much more they're complex and nuanced in cases like this, and I think some of the nuance in them, the potential nuance, comes into clearer focus when we distinguish in the ways I'm trying to do in this book between the commitment to affirming something and its evaluation as good or bad. These things can come apart, and they can come apart in ways that I think might make sense of otherwise puzzling situations like that of adults who both maybe affirm their own condition, their own hearing impairment, but nevertheless decide to take steps that will overcome that same condition in their children. I think that's a perfectly coherent set of attitudes once we tease apart retrospective affirmation and positive evaluative judgment or justification.
Right, right. So now moving on, because you're right that the this discussion begins to move in the direction of the final chapter of the book, which is squarely about cases involving regrettable past circumstances that are not tied to one's own agency, or might not even be tied to agency at all.
Yeah.
And you raise this is very provocative, and I would say really, really compelling and interesting. The last chapter is devoted to a discussion of what you call the bourgeois predicament. So let me just ask you. So tell us, what's the bourgeois predicament? What are we talking about here?
Good. Yeah. I mean, the bourgeois predicament, it's a little bit provocative, but it's personal for me. And I think for many people in my situation, the idea here really is a fairly simple one, but it's that many of us who have the good fortune to live in conditions of comparative affluence, have built our lives around, I'm not talking about, the extravagant activities of the 1% or such, but, take university professors who have the good fortune to work in, fairly ambitious and well-endowed and well-funded universities. My assumption is that, the philosophical activities in these kind of contexts are undeniably valuable. They're the sorts of things that can make for a extremely rewarding and meaningful life, and provide the people who engage in the activities with a powerful basis for affirming their lives as they lead them. It seems to me an obvious fact that these very activities are conditioned and made possible by broader social and historical conditions that are objectively lamentable, right? So, and in particular, I'm thinking here of, global inequalities in the distribution of resources and access to opportunities, which regardless of whether we think of, the vast disparities of, resources and opportunities in the world as matters of global injustice or not, they're unquestionably, it seems to me, lamentable. The world would be a better place if things were more equitably distributed, including resources and opportunities. But my, I think, fairly compelling hypothesis seems to me fairly obvious hypothesis is that, contemporary, elite research universities would not exist in their current form in a world in which resources and opportunities were distributed more equitably. That's not to say there would be no philosophy, there would be no universities or no philosophy, philosophical activities in the world, but it seems to me they'd be unimaginably different from the form that they take in the current world, where the elite universities support cultural activities of this sort at a high level, in part because they control disproportionate resources and are connected to a culture of people who are hugely advantaged in the distribution of global resources. So if these background assumptions are plausible, then people like myself, we find ourselves in the situation that I call the bourgeois predicament, where Like Gauguin, our lives are organized around valuable activities. I don't question the value of philosophical research in elite research environments. Our lives acquire meaning and significance in virtue of containing in them these kinds of activities, and that commits us to affirming unconditionally those activities and the conditions that make them possible. And those conditions include these lamentable global inequalities that it would be better if the world did not contain, right? So we're in a situation where our valuable activities, the bourgeois predicament is just the predicament that arises for those of us who are in this fortunate position where the value of the activities around which we organize our lives is connected in ways to lamentable social and historical conditions in ways that commit us to affirming those very conditions. And this is a kind of absurd situation, since it's very obvious to us that the conditions that make possible our valuable activities are lamentable. And it's an uncomfortable predicament to confront. I think a lot of us try to avoid it in various ways by, avoiding thinking about it. But the situation is there to be confronted, and it seems to me it's uncomfortable for us once we make clear to us the relation between the viable activities that give meaning to our lives and the things, the objectionable social conditions that make those activities possible in the first place.
So, right. So the book closes then with what you refer to as a pessimistic conclusion.
Yes.
And you discuss, I should mention, you discuss sort of three possible and I would guess sort of popular responses to the bourgeois predicament, and you say none of these is actually going to get us out of the predicament, and
right.
In fact, none of them actually offer us much consolation.
Yes.
For the conclusion, which is looming, that in a way we are. Let me see if I can put this just right.
Okay,
we are. Sort of psychologically compelled to affirm our lives when they are devoted to projects and aspirations that are of value, which our lives tend to be.
Yeah.
And so there's no way of getting rid of the attitude, right?
Right.
There's no way of getting rid of the affirmation.
Yeah.
But there's also no way on reflection of shaking the other realization, which is that these very activities to which we are attached and which are objectively valuable and so on are made possible only or to say made possible by histories and conditions that are intrinsically and again objectively, perhaps we might even say stronger, incontrovertibly, sort of objectionable.
Right.
So is this conclusion an existentialist conclusion that we're sort of doomed to a kind of bad faith, or is it a nihilistic? Maybe these aren't such different options. Is this a nihilistic conclusion? How, besides calling it pessimistic, which we can feel the force of the pessimism,
right.
Philosophically, how would you characterize this sort of inevitability of being trapped in this predicament?
Good. I do think it has kind of existentialist character, and I talk about Nietzsche a bit in this context. I mean, to be clear, the bourgeois predicament illustrates the general structure of the problem, right? Where you've got something of value in your life that you're attached to, and your attitude of attachment commits you to affirming the conditions of that thing. And so in the bourgeois predicament, the valuable activities, because they're so obviously conditioned by lamentable inequalities in the distribution of resources and opportunities, we can see fairly transparently the relation between the valuable activities that we're attached to and the lamentable social conditions that that we're thereby committed to affirming. But the worry though is that this situation structurally generalizes to virtually anyone who's committed to anything. Right.
Right.
Just to be committed to something valuable is, insofar as to be attached to it, to be attached to a person is to be implicitly committed to affirming the necessary historical conditions of the existence of the person. And, you know, for all we know, those conditions might include, you know, historical atrocities, wars that caused, you know, migrations that brought, you know, two people together who gave birth to your great-grandmother or something like that, or the great-grandmother, the person whom you now love, who would not therefore have existed without that lamentable larger historical condition. Now,
or even closer still, there might just be, you know, even more locally, you might say, just sort of ways in which societies are structured along objectionable class lines.
Yeah.
And that plays you know, those lines play a crucial causal role in, you know, how you met all of the people who are really important
exactly.
to you.
Right. I mean, for virtually any attachment, there are countless ways in which that might be conditioned by things that we, you know, when we face up to them, are you know, they're not things we did. We're not talking about decisions we've taken. We're talking about, you know, historical and social conditions. But they're ones that we find objectionable and objectively lamentable. Now, I connect this up to Nietzsche's idea of the eternal recurrence of the same, which is, you know, often puzzled me as a kind of, I think it's puzzled many people as a kind of condition for what Nietzsche called the affirmation of life. Was your, you know, you can affirm your life only if you're willing to affirm the eternal recurrence of world history, the totality of world history, the recurrence of world history for all eternity. And it's a doctrine that people have tried to interpret in a variety of ways. But I think I'm not a Nietzsche scholar, but I think there's a way of making sense of this that links it up to the general structures of attitude that I talk about in the book. And I go into this a bit in the conclusion. And the idea here is just that, you know, for all we know, our attachment to some particular individual or project might commit us to affirming virtually anything in virtue right. of the relate, you know, any feature of world history insofar as, you know, for all we know, if that feature of world history hadn't occurred, then the thing that we affirm wouldn't have existed or wouldn't have been possible, right? And so, you know, we can think of eternal recurrence as a kind of regulative ideal. You can really affirm your life and the things, the individuals that you love and the projects that give your life meaning. You can affirm these things fully only if you're prepared to affirm the totality of world history, because for all you know, your attitude of affirmation towards your life and the things that give it meaning might already commit you to affirming the most you know, egregiously objectionable features of the larger world history in which our lives are bound up. And you know, that's an unnerving conclusion, I think, a conclusion that has a kind of existentialist character, perhaps. I describe it in the conclusion as involving a modest form of nihilism. I say a modest form of nihilism because the argument of the book doesn't, I mean, some extreme forms of nihilism deny any distinctions of value and, you know, deny that there's anything that's genuinely good or valuable or worthwhile in the world, and that's certainly not one of my premises, but you know, the conclusion nevertheless, it seems to me, can accurately be described as involving an element of nihilism, because it says that each of us has attitudes towards our own lives and the people we love that don't ultimately make sense, right. They involve an element of unconditional affirmation of the conditions that made our attachments possible in the first place, that, you know, that isn't adequate to the conditions that we inhabit. We're committed to affirming things that aren't ultimately really worthy of being affirmed, in right. virtue of affirming our lives and the things in our lives that give them meaning and significance. And, you know, so there's something absurd about our attitude towards our own lives. That reflects the, you know, the uncomfortable fact that we inhabit a world in which the things that we value and that make it possible for us to value our lives are conditioned by things that are unquestionably, you know, abominations. That's, you know, that's
Excellent.
And that's part of the human predicament, it seems to me. And we should, I'm not recommending that people give up or be depressed about it, but we should face up to this. That's,
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, Jay, you've been very, very generous with your time, and I want to thank you so much for joining me on New Books in Philosophy to talk about your book, The View from Here.
Yeah, thank you very much, Bob. It's been fun talking to you, and I very much appreciate your interest.
Sure. Well, take care now.
Okay. You too.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor R. J. Wallace of the University of California at Berkeley. We were talking about his new book, The View from Here, on Affirmation, Attachment, and the Limits of Regret, which is newly published by Oxford University Press. I am Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. I thank you for listening.